Welcome to the Sunstone Podcast, everyone, where there is always more than one way to Mormon. I'm Stephen Carter, and I'll be introducing this week's episode. Do you remember that General Conference talk from about 5 years ago, where there was an apostle that said that there were counterfeit families? In response, Sunstone held a conference called the Summit on the Family. We invited people with many different kinds of families to come speak. The conference was so popular that we actually did it again at our summer symposium. The panelists for this session were LaShawn Williams, who was a licensed clinical social worker based in Utah and a single mother; Geralyn Hassel Poole, who was a digital and print artist. You may know her as the developer of the Dang You to Heck card game. She works with the queer community in Utah County. Brady Williams, who was a former Mormon fundamentalist and one of the stars of the TLC reality television show My Five Wives. Richard Osler, who was the author of Bridges, Ministering to Those Who Question, and Listen, Learn, and Love, Improving Latter-day Saint Culture. And finally, Weston Clark, who is the Director of Community Outreach for the Salt Lake City Mayor's Office.
When we initially did this panel as an idea, there were three questions that we were given to consider, and it was, what's the dynamic of your family? How has the dynamic blessed your life? And what challenges have you faced because of the structure of your family? And I wanted to share the many layers of my family dynamics, and I want to kind of walk you through them and then talk with you about how I make sense of them and how they walk with me into church every Sunday on the Sundays that I go, which is the days that I have to teach. Okay, so this is me and my mother, circa 1980-something. My mom is a military nurse, retired as a major. She worked in trauma and med-surg and everything else, and we were a single family when we started. So my mother joined the church in 1981. She joined in the military because in 80-ish, she heard that they were getting a new doctor. The doctor was a Mormon. Mormons don't like black people. And she said, well, I don't really care what religion is. As long as it's a good doctor, that's fine. He came in, and instantly they had a really good relationship, and they began ministering with one another. His family really enveloped her into their family, took care of her. She was in the middle of her second divorce with my father because dynamics were that awesome. And they took her in and took her to church. And we went from being a military family of me and my mom, and our earliest memories of me being in church, my mother, we were having sacrament. And it was one morning, you know, single moms running around and whatnot, so the bread's coming around, and she's like, take two pieces, you're hungry. So I was like, okay, great, take two pieces, right? Maybe I had done something that week, and yeah, I needed two pieces, I don't know. But we just had this entering of coming into church and coming into this really structured and organized process. She says that when I was little, I would look around our church congregation. I asked her, Mom, are we white? And she said, no, and why would you think that? And I was like, well, everybody else in here is, so I thought maybe that we were too, right? So it's two-year-old logic. It's developmentally appropriate, so this is an appropriate question for me to ask as a child. So then we moved into becoming a part member family. My mother married my stepfather in 1986 or 87. We became a part member family. We are by culture and by roots Southern Baptist. And so we had the Southern Baptist, Mormon, military family thing that became us and who we are. Then as I grew up and dated within the LDS Church, I knew that having an interracial family might have been part of my future, so that's one piece that I'll discuss. And now I am the single black divorced female family dynamics. I'm going to kind of walk you through each of those and discuss kind of how it all pulls together within about 10 minutes. As military Mormons, I moved every single year, second grade until 10th grade, twice in 9th grade. Everywhere that we went, church was the same, family was the same, and that was about it. We began our moves through my mother. She got divorced twice. June 8th, 1978, my mother joined in 81 because had she joined any time before 1978, June 8th, 1978, Salt Lake headquarters would have heard from her and they would have known it was time to remove the ban. But she joined after they got revelation, so now here we are. Part of my mother's conversion story was getting her patriarchal blessing and being blessed to have whole children, whole healthy children. I'm a preemie. I was born at 24 or 26 weeks, depending on which parent you ask. I was 2 pounds, 8 ounces, or 1 pound, 11 ounces, depending on which parent you ask. Still here and, you know, fought to be here. My mother really loved the focus on family. She really loved the idea that she would have healthy children because before me, she had a stillborn. Before me, she had miscarriages. She had a lot of trauma to her body that impacted her ability to birth and to have children. So the church meant a great deal to her so far as family was concerned, and she passed that on to us. So part member Mormons, this is my mom, Deonce, I call her because her name is Diane, but she's basically Beyonce. So this is Deonce, and I just found out that my stepdad has like Jay-Z's cologne, so now it's like Jones Z and Deonce. As a part member family, understand that coming into seminary at 14 and hearing DNC, basically this is the temple marriage piece. Their covenant and marriage are not a force when they are dead. When they're out of the world, therefore, they are not bound by any law when they are out of the world. So that's if a man marry a wife in the world, and he married her not by me, nor by my word or the covenant, then their marriage does not mean anything when they leave. So now she's got me. I'm the oldest of five. And we're reading this in seminary. It's an existential crisis, right? For us, like, oh, our families are going to die. We're all going to be, you know, off somewhere in the outer darkness, but like not really like the outer like sunset dusk maybe-ish area. Okay, so that when they're out of the world, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are appointed angels in heaven. Angels are ministering servants. Black folk don't want to be ministering servants here or in heaven, but here we are again with this part member family thing. Like, we are just, it's not fun, but now we're ministering servants again. Pay attention, okay? Which, to minister for those who are worthy of a far more and an exceeding and an eternal weight of glory. Like, ain't that about it? Where I come from, that would have ended very differently, but You see what our scripture does to us as part member families. This is important, okay? Because we don't talk about part member families that much. But here you have a black part member family, and now we're being told not only June 8th, 1978, but now DNC 132. That impacts us. It impacts how we look. So now me, growing up being the oldest of five, setting an example, right? I'm going to get married in the temple. I'm going to do all these wonderful, awesome things. I'm going to fix this. I'm not going to be a ministering angel out there in outer dusk, okay? So if the angels do not abide my law, therefore they cannot be enlarged, but remain separately and singly without exaltation in their safe condition to all eternity. And from henceforth are not gods, but are angels of God forever and ever. I just want to actually get to heaven. So if I can be an angel, that's cool. But I kind of like the God thing also. So, I mean, I'd like to progress, right? So this puts me on my path of I'm going to fix this wrongness of my part member family. So part member Mormons, I did not serve a mission, but that guy did, and that girl did, and that girl did, and the baby sister did not. But from our part member family, like this is our pedigree, right? I've got 3 returned missionaries in my family, so we're okay. We're always hustling for worthiness as a part member family. 3 missionaries, 3 full-time missionaries that served honorably and came home and whatnot, right? Cool, great. I didn't serve a mission because I was coming into my own, and I was like, yeah, if you ask me why the ban happened, you're going to send me home for my mission, so don't send me. So, part member Mormons, now interracial Mormons, military, Southern Baptist family, grew up in North Carolina. And so I got to grow up with Spencer W. Kimball being quoted to me about what the prophet said about interracial marriage. So now this is in this whole dating, chase, right? So, you know what the prophet says about interracial marriages? And he says, cultural differences pose danger for marriage. When I said you must teach your people to overcome their prejudices and accept the Indians, I didn't mean to encourage intermarriage. He's honest, right? He can find honestly. I mean, they should be brothers to worship together and work together and play together, but we must discourage intermarriage, not because it's a sin. I'd like to make this very emphatic. A couple has not committed sin if an Indian boy and a white girl are married or vice versa. It isn't a transgression like the transgressions of which many are guilty, but it is not expedient. Marriage stats and our general experience convince us that marriage is not easy, amen. It is difficult when all factors are favorable. The divorces increase constantly, even when the spouses have the same general background of race, religion, finance, education, and otherwise, says President Kimball. He then says the interrace marriage problem is not one of inferiority or superiority. It may be that your son is better educated. And he goes through this whole thing, right? So if your son thinks he loves this girl, he would not want to inflict upon her loneliness and unhappiness. And if he thinks that his affection for her will solve all her problems, he should do some more mature thinking. I actually agree with that. But I grew up with folks telling me not the entire context of this man's quote, but the prophet says you shouldn't marry interracially. So then what am I to do? I dated interracially because that's all I had at church. And I'm supposed to get a temple marriage, so there's white boys. So here we are. 94 to 2000, this is high school through sophomore year of college. Me am a white boy, okay? Missionary, didn't go on a mission. We just were on a wrong path together, but like united, right? So then I got it right, and I got married in 2006 to my not-returned missionary white boy in the temple. It was awesome, right? It was great. But then we opted to, like, no longer be married in 2016. Praise God. Almost 2 years free and divorced. Woo! Cannot wait to celebrate in November. Amen. Okay. But now we have interracial families. And so it's a really important thing to talk to folks about marrying cross-culturally. There are conversations you want to have. Because now when we are a lot more active in exploring our faith and we're talking about faith crises or faith transitions, you might go from being a temple family to a part member family, and then what? Now if you're an interracial family that was already screwed up, now you're an interracial or interracial now part member, like, these things can start weighing on you if you don't have your feet grounded in why you got married. That's an important piece. We go from being these interracial Mormons who kind of like grow through and grow into and really like you grow out of marriage. And you decide, you know, this is no longer going to work because I thought I was going to have these dark-skinned, wonderful, lovely, beautiful children, right? And all three of them came out white. One green-eyed, one blue-eyed. They're all super light. And I'm like, God has a sense of humor because this is some bull. And I love each of them individually and collectively, but it added another layer onto, okay, how am I going to raise these kids in this church, in my family, with the questions that are bound to come to them? Because I was always told that I came from cursed blood. And so I waited for my kids to carry along that curse too. And so I'm sitting here like I'm geared up to make sure that my spouse and I are ready to talk and teach our kids that they're not cursed and everything else. They come out pure white and delightsome. I am now a single black divorce family. So what does that mean in the LDS church? I'm a single black female, three kids, that tries to maintain a co-parenting relationship with their dad. My kids always see us as a family. My mantra, F it, I'll do it. It's not what I signed up for, but it is what I have. And it's what I committed to carry because of how I believe in families being eternal. What I end up doing is all of these things here with my kids. None of it is perfect. But I'm constantly unlearning and constant teaching, deconstructing, and explaining to my kids what's right and what's wrong, and what they will never let anybody say to them without having mommy come back in and correct it. I have to talk to them about skin color, curses, what it means to them to still be in the covenant and to stay in the covenant. But at the end of the day, it's these faces, through the battle fatigue, through the assumptions of why I got divorced because I mowed my own lawn, through the assumptions about me getting married again, I don't want to go to a singles ward, don't introduce me to your uncle, your cousin, or your brother, I'm good. My maiden name, my married name, I'm still Sister Schultz at church, but my maiden name is Williams. That transition is big. But I believe my family is eternal. I've never fit into the mold, and I don't need to, but I believe that there is a mansion for me. This proclamation said nothing about me when I read it. It has nothing to do with me now when I read it again. But the family that I come from, Elijah Abel, and the pioneers that went before me, stayed here when people told them that they were not welcome. That stays true for me and for my family as well. So thank you for your time.
I guess we're all looking at LaShawn's family. It's fine. When we originally did this panel for the Mormon Family Summit, I was speaking about my interaction with the Family Proclamation, which has not always been, never been good. So the first time I ever heard the proclamation, I was a young mother with little kids, and I was sitting in that Relief Society meeting, and God said, "That's not for you," to me in that meeting. I heard it. At the time, my husband was in school, but he suffered from some pretty severe mental health issues. And I knew that being the breadwinner for the family, it was going to land on me. And hearing those words that mothers have to nurture and fathers have to provide hurt me. And immediately the words came to me, "It's not for you." And that was a really powerful moment for me. And ever since then, the proclamation has never been something that I've applied to my life. Now, years ago, I rewrote the proclamation to be more gender neutral so it would fit our family, and someone in Salt Lake didn't like that, and I took a lot of phone calls from Intellectual Reserve. And then when I told them to put it in writing, they told my stake president to talk to me about it. So we had some lovely conversations about that, and now I no longer have it. Last year, I redid the proclamation again in a way that would maybe not get me in so much trouble to be much more gender inclusive. As my understanding of family has grown from that moment when I learned the proclamation is not for you, my understanding of what family means has also grown. Years ago, the church said something about counterfeit families, that gay families are counterfeit families. I was very angry, and as is my way as a graphic artist, the first thing I did was make some memes about what families looked like. And I created a series of families that were not the standard proclamation families. And I posted it online. And immediately people were saying, "Okay, that's wonderful, but what about my family?" And it's been years now, and that image, and I don't have it here, I'm very sorry, like I said, the gerbils. But that has grown. And I remember the first time I put it up, somebody said, well, my family is polyamorous, which means there are more adults involved in this family. And I thought, well, I'm going to add them to my graphic. Because what it came down to was the children matter. The kids in these families are what matter. These children have to know that they belong to a family, and not that everyone has children. So people were saying, "Well, okay, but I don't have children. I have a cat. That's my family." And I was like, "You know what? Valid. Let's add that to the graphic." And I'm not trying to be a gatekeeper of families. I'm trying to represent what all families look like. And then I included my most controversial image. Actually, is the polygamist family. But again, like, that's a family. There are no counterfeit families. My good friend from Mexico, Anya, said, that's really great. You don't have enough brown people. And I said, oh, you're right. So then I changed to include many more brown people. And then my friend Jamie said, that's wonderful. You don't have any Muslim families. So as the years have gone by, my image has grown and grown and grown, and families have grown and grown and grown. And it's wonderful. To me, it's this wonderful sort of pushback on the proclamation. Sorry, in our work with Queer Meals, we now have hundreds of kids that call us mom and dad. So even our own family has grown and grown and grown, and our family is made up of all kinds of wonderful people, black, brown, white, they're all queer. But anyway, every Christmas my mom says, I really want a family photo. I'm like, Mom, I don't know how that's going to happen. But she's like, no, you're family. So this year my mom's getting a drone, and we're taking a family picture of like 100 or so people, which is going to be pretty incredible and will annoy her. Anyway, so as my understanding of family has grown, I'm hoping that the images that I'm putting out there and the stuff that I'm putting out there is helping other people's understanding of what makes a Mormon family or even just a family expand.
What I really appreciate about this panel is each one of us has a different story to tell about a Mormon family and what that can look like. And, you know, the Mormon universe is a lot bigger than just mainstream LDS. I think when we share our stories, because everybody has their own story, and when we can share our narrative, it helps us to understand that the world's a lot smaller place, that we really share in many, many more things than what we're different. And that realization lightens our world and takes away a lot of the darkness. And so I want to share my story, our story, about an alternative family. And I'm going to just do it through some pictures. So that's me, and then Rhonda and Polly, Rosemary, Robin, and Noni. We have lots of kids. I have 25 kids. And for all intents and purposes, we look like a pretty normal family. So there's all different types of polygamous families as well. There I am with my two grandkids and my youngest. She's 3 years old now, sitting there cuddling with me. And the mother of my two grandchildren is 25. I have some goofball sons, just like anybody else. I grew up in the LDS church until I was 16 years old, mainstream LDS. And then I converted to the AUB when I was 16, 17. And there I moved through the ranks, if you will, and became a leader within the AUB. Pretty soon things started happening, and I just didn't fit. And there were a lot of aspects of fundamentalism that didn't work well with me. And we, as a family, and particularly me and the wives, started to embrace a more progressive worldview. But we still participate in rituals. Here's one day where I baptized three of my kids that were all born that same year, Mara, Tommy, and Rachel. That boy right above my head is Josh. And he joined the mainstream LDS church, served a mission in Ecuador, and just was recently married to his sweetheart that he found in Ecuador, and they've moved here. So we have a big diversity, and also the boy on the end, he just got married, and he's in the LDS church. There's so many for us to love. And I want you to see this, and I want you to understand that we're a happy family. We're a different family. We don't have just, I don't know what. Typical LDS families, four kids. At least that's what my mom had. We have 25. And there's my grandpa. And I include this because this was a real big deal for my grandpa. He He's multi-generational. My great-great-grandpa was in Nauvoo and was a polygamist, but he was very mainstream. And for 2 years after I joined the polygamist group, he wouldn't talk to me. And to see him here with, I think I have children from, no, I don't have children from every wife in this picture, but three wives are in this represented in this picture. And for him to actually take a picture with all those children is a yeoman's effort. And the reason why is because I just wouldn't let him ignore me. And I kept sharing my life with him. And pretty soon, you know, before he died, he gave all my wives a kiss on the lip, you know, those sloppy grandpa kisses on the lip, and said that he loved them. And that's what needs to happen. And that happens by telling our stories, but more importantly, listening to the stories of others. And we told our story in a big way. There's outside of CBS Studios. These are my triplets. They each have a different mom, but they all graduated the same year, and they're inseparable as if they were just triplets. I just want to talk and just say that everybody has a different story, and our polygamy is a different. We've embraced what we call a progressive polygamy, where we try to abandon a lot of fundamentalism, and we want to tell our story and have everybody get to know us and us get to know them. And so, thank you.
Hi, my name is Richard Osler. My story started when I was a singles ward bishop in the Salt Lake City area, and I had kind of two groups of YSAs that were meeting with me, the ones that would work through my executive secretary, and then about two-thirds of our ward was not active, but I was really active on social media and started to connect with a lot of those that were not going, and to the point where a lot felt comfortable coming to talk to me. And it was the first time in my life I started to hear stories of people sort of outside of my circle. And I maybe did 1,000 interviews with people that had stepped away or never been fully connected. And I always felt my job was to listen. After a while, it became clear to me the best thing I could do to heal people and to serve people was really to listen and hear their stories. And I became less of a fixer and more of a healer by listening to people. And some then were able to find their way into mainstream Mormonism, but some weren't. And I was willing to walk wherever they wanted to walk, as far as what they felt was the right journey. Self-determination is a really important principle to me, that everybody gets to decide the right path that works for them. And my job is to honor that path, and I believe that's part of our doctrine. Now, there's some boundaries to that. ISIS wants to destroy me, so I'm not particularly, you know, want to support ISIS. And so there is some us versus them in my world, but it's pretty broad out there. You know, Weston's in a wonderful same-sex marriage. I've gotten to see him and his husband and their family, and I feel no us versus them. I just feel, you know, wonderful man doing the best he can in his life, and I honor his path, and we'll hear more about that and the beauty of his path. The second thing I wanted to communicate is a little bit about LGBTQ. Diane Oviatt is here, one of my mentors as I got into this world, but I felt impressed to do what I would call a hard drive reset. And I realized straight people had told me my whole life how to feel about gay people or LGBTQ people. And I said, that's wrong. And the policy statements triggered that for me and a few gay people in our ward. And I felt like you should go talk to LGBTQ people and you will help. And this is sort of God talking to me. Then you will help understand how I see LGBTQ people. And I didn't know the degree of homophobia I had within me. So I just felt impressed. I'm wiping my hard drive clean, and I'm going to go talk to LGBTQ people. And that's when I got much more connected to LGBTQ. Because I was into social media, started to talk a lot more about this on social media as a really committed, I still am a pretty, very committed Orthodox Mormon, whatever that means. And I'm totally in the church, and I totally believe in the church, but I totally get why the church is in everybody's path, and I honor everybody's path. We started an organization called listenlearnandlove.org, and it's a content to really help more of us understand our LGBTQ. I like to call them God's LGBTQ children, not a different community. They're our own people. So if you want to learn more about some of the things that I'm sharing, it's at listenlearnandlove.org, and that's a website we've set up with a lot of content and podcasts and stories. I love this idea of belonging versus fitting in. And those words are kind of synonyms for me, but I read a chapter in Brené Brown that changed that for me. And I realized fitting in is where we become something we're not to be able to fit in. And that is the sort of the square peg in the round hole. Belonging is where we're able to fit in based on who we are and our authentic selves. And there's a need to belong. And there's need to find community where we can belong everywhere. And for some of our wonderful members, it's really hard to fit into the church right now. And we need to do a better job within our church of letting people belong based on where they are and not asking them to be a certain way or feel a certain way or see things a certain way. So I believe very much in Big Tent Mormonism that the church, 2 minutes left, the church needs to work. There's no belief or behavior hurdle to feel welcome in a Mormon congregation, that everybody needs to feel permission to feel how they feel authentically and be able to share how they feel. And small ball Mormonism is where it's kind of the fitting in mentality that only those that culturally fit or... I just want to read a Facebook post in closing that I did this yesterday that's just kind of my way of sharing how I feel. And it starts, "Please don't let white people tell you how black people feel. Let men tell you how women feel. Let straight people tell you how LGBTQ people feel. Let those in our restored church tell you how those who left feel. Let one political party tell you how those in another political party feel. Let married people tell you how single or divorced people feel. Let legal people tell you how undocumented workers feel. I'm trying to listen better. First, learning from people in other groups before forming opinions. For me, Christ washing the feet of his disciples is a powerful visual example of the humility I'm trying to learn so that I can listen to and learn from others, which helps me better see us all as all members of the same human family. It also helps me understand the nature of the cross my friends are carrying so I can better mourn, comfort, and help bear their burdens. Thank you."
This is my first Sunstone, and I have to say, if I knew there was such a group of edgy people like you, I'd probably have stuck around a lot longer. This is very cool. Hi, my name is Weston Clark. I'm a husband, a father, and I'm here to tell you about my Mormon family. To be honest, it's a little strange saying that. I haven't considered myself Mormon in a really long time. But it is impossible to deny that Mormonism hasn't played a huge role in shaping my life and my family. First, a little background. Here's a picture of me and my sisters. My little brother didn't come around for another 5 years or so. This is probably also the year that my parents let me decide if I was going to get baptized or not. They let me decide that. Growing up, the church and its influence was everywhere. Mormon until proven otherwise. My extended family was incredibly devout. All church milestones were celebrated and broadcast far and wide. The pressure to conform was still very strong from just about every angle. Family, school, scouts. Thankfully, my parents created somewhat of a protected bubble. We were probably the least devout of my whole extended family. My dad always tells the story of his mission to Indiana, where he was there for 6 months, and he decided he was done, and he wanted to go home. So my grandpa flew to Indiana to convince him to stay and work things out, and my dad committed to stay for the rest of the time. Grandpa flew home. 2 weeks later, my dad hitchhiked home. Despite both of my parents' mediocre devotion to the church, I think they felt compelled to expose us kids when we came around. We attended off and on through the years. I mean, Easter Sunday, for sure. And even though our breakfast regimen remained uninterrupted, my parents always gave fast Sunday offerings. Not much. I mean, Malto meal cereal doesn't cost much anyway, right? They don't drink, smoke, or swear, but my mom will say stupid and butt occasionally. In fact, not long ago, my mom divulged to my dad that she had been drinking coffee for a little while. That was kind of a big deal. I was baptized at 8, my older sisters the same day, upon my convincing. As I got older, I continued to go back and forth with Mormonism. Pressures to be Mormon, attend church, and go to seminary were strong and omnipresent in suburban Utah. I tried seminary a few times off and on, with the last attempt as a senior in high school, early morning seminary, which, come on, are you really trying to chase people away with that? That's just silly. A lot of my back and forth seemed to correlate with the ebb and flow of my desire to fix myself. Here's a picture of me and my now husband almost 20 years ago, a few short months after we met. I promise we were happier than this picture makes us look. We were going for a mood, I guess. I don't know. This picture was taken shortly after I came out to my sister, because I knew my hidden relationship with him was progressing, and I had hoped she would take some pictures of us, and we had no phones for a selfie. It was terrifying to ask her, but she was the rebel of the family. She was the first one to buy me my first alcoholic drink, the one to constantly be at odds with my parents, and I felt like I could trust her the most. I don't know what possessed me to want the pictures, but I treasure them now, as some of them are the earliest photos of our forbidden relationship. When I finally came out to my family, it was incredibly hard. We have to be ready. You have to be ready and willing to lose it all. Luckily, I had an incredible network of friends that I knew would catch me if I fell. I told my sister, the photographer, first, and then I'm not sure how everyone else found out. I spent months in a bizarre fog where I don't know who knew what, and until at one point I just assumed everybody knew. There was a lot of not talking about it, awkward moments, and some weird anger that came out in bizarre ways. I moved out of my house to escape the awkwardness and tenseness of it all. The distance helped. I have to also think that my family's subpar relationship with the church also helped. I had an incredible amount of anger then. I know it came from my inability to be open, honest, and safe throughout my late teens. It came from the church's statements and stances on homosexuality, which overpowered already built-in relationships I had had for my whole life with family and friends. It came from that incredibly awkward feeling I'd get with every girl I took to a school dance, every lie I had to tell about my feelings, every night I stayed up crying due to utter hopelessness, every feeling I had and hated and repressed, and every adolescent milestone I passed through with unfathomable amounts of terror, depression, and embarrassment. If they see me dance, will they think I'm gay? If I don't hold her hand right, will they think I'm gay? If I don't like the right music, am I flirting correctly? Am I walking correctly? What's the one thing that's going to give me away? I was robbed of this time in my life by a culture bent on crushing me. Certainly, the LDS Church was as much a product of the times as any other homophobic institution, but it was my institution. It was the one that was supposed to be perfect. It was the one true church on this planet. It was the system of living my entire extended family was devoted to, and it was rejecting me. Brandon and I moved out of Utah together, spending a year outside of Zion. I missed my family incredibly. My nieces and nephews were beginning to be born, so daringly we moved back. I think when you grow up gay in Utah, you develop a bit of an activist heart. Adversity becomes your safe place of comfort. We bought a house together and soon decided to grow our family. It was illegal at the time for us to do it, but we found a way. I have no doubt that the Mormon cultural devotion to family and ingrained need to have kids played a role in that decision. So in 2010, we created our own path to adopt our son, Xander, transforming our lives forever. 3 years later, we decided to do it again, and in the course of 1 month, December 13th, we bought a new house, we moved, we got married on live TV, and flew to Michigan to await the birth of our baby girl, Zoe. Since then, we've become just about as boring as any other family in the world. We are soccer dads, dance dads, vacation dads, field trip dads, camping dads, and even hair dads. Okay, I'm the hair dad. That's me. Here we are just last fall. This family is my everything in the whole world. Our relationship with the church continues to evolve. Even though I have mentally and spiritually parted ways with the church long ago, it still plays a heavy role in my life. I have zero relationship with many of my extended family that I was close to growing up. Some of that is due to aging and geographic distance, but many of those relationships exploded in a blaze of Facebook glory during Proposition 8, marriage equality, and of course the more recent rule regarding children of same-sex parents. Even without an explosion or parting words, the awkwardness of my family dealing with my sexuality was too much for most of our relationship to take, and they were never the same. You know, Mormonism plays a huge role in our family still. My rebel sister is now the most devout LDS of my entire immediate family. And in fact, we do what we can to support her family, and this is us attending my niece's baptism not too long ago. And I can tell you that the conversation in the car with my kids on the way there was incredibly awkward, because they don't know what it was, so we explained what it was. My kids are biracial. We think it's important to be incredibly honest to them about race, racism, prejudice. They live in a same-sex parent family. We talk about homophobia all the time. And so we tell them very bluntly about the LDS Church stance on same-sex families and how they really cannot be, they can't do what their cousins are doing without disavowing their parents. And that's like an incredible burden to put on the shoulders of children. And I can't believe it. I mentioned that at one time I was incredibly angry at the church, and certainly there's a lot of anger still there. It and other archaically minded organizations and institutions robbed me of much of my youth and happiness for many, many years, and that is hard to forgive, and there are kids still working their way through the gauntlet. But I've grown, I've learned to love so many things the church has given me, and realize how much of me is a product of the culture and environment I was raised. It has given me a love for my community and for my family. I grew up with those things being the pinnacle of everything important in life. And so, as an obedient follower of these ideals, I'm now a family man, with a family I would do anything for, fight for, and stand up for whenever I can. I care deeply about my community and love to help my neighbors where I can. For those reasons, I can probably thank the church for my family, and I can probably thank them for making me a Democrat, too. In many ways, the church created me and then rejected me, which is incredibly hurtful. I believe there is so much potential for the church to actually lead with the foundation of the family. All they have to do is broaden their definition to include all families, single-parent families, families of one, families with two dads, etc. It is so simple. Love one another. Thank you.